So hi and welcome to the Movies You Love podcast, the podcast where every other week, or I guess for this episode, every other month, because guys, I messed up again, I get to sit down with a film lover over the internet and discuss a film that helped them fall in love with movies. And before I get to this episode's guests, which I'm sure all you guys will love because he is probably one of the most interesting yes, I'm doing it, guys. I'm picking a favorite. Actually, no, I'm not. I'm playing. He's just really, really good at being a great interview guest, and I'm happy to have him on. But as I was saying, before I get to that, because I'm not going to say his name yet, I want to just talk about this month gone by, because the thing about it is that there are many excuses I can give you guys for why things went haywire. I remembered I recorded this episode over 2 weeks ago, and 2 weeks ago I was already pre-planning what I was going to talk about in my intro. I was going to talk about the fact that the World Cup is on, and why am I spending time recording and editing podcasts when the World Cup is on, and I was going to talk about how sad I was that the World Cup is on and England is out. Between the time of the episode previous, the episode with Ed Douglas talking about Brazil, and this episode that was supposed to come out 2 weeks ago, I already had a World Cup start and England was out. What was I going to do with my time? How was I going to be excited for things again? But the World Cup is still on and it's exciting. And then last week, I don't feel bad saying this because he's already put it online, so sure, he's okay with the world knowing it. My dad broke his leg. Actually, his ankle. And he's in the bed now and we're going hand and foot for him and for a few days. I mean, I wasn't really worried or anything because, I mean, everyone breaks their foot every once in a while, don't they? I mean, I haven't yet, but people do. And it's a normal thing at this stage in the world where we know how to deal with these kinds of issues. We don't any longer go like, well, I guess we have to chop that one off. I mean, and guys, he's fine. He's in bed now. He has a cast on. The only problem is, you know, he's just antsy and wants to move around, which is what we would all want to do. It's what I would want to do. While I personally enjoy resting and sleeping and being in bed all day every once in a while, if you tell me that I would literally have to be in bed for 6 weeks or without getting out or with doing minimal activity other than what I have to do for the sake of keeping my muscles working and not getting any other complications, guys, I would go batty, right? You would have to, there would be so many things I'd want to be doing with myself. Like, watching movies would no longer be a concern of mine. I would get sick of movies. I'd be like, guys, I am running a marathon tomorrow. I don't care about this leg. But he's doing fine and we're managing, and it was an interesting experience dealing with the hospitals here, because while I've had my experiences with hospitals, it's mainly been private experiences where I know I'm sick, I know I'm going to the hospital, it's not an emergency, I can go to my doctor, I can make an appointment, I can go and do all these things privately, and while, of course, the cost is there, we don't really have to worry about a lot of logistical issues with going to an emergency room. So I think it was really my first time ever being in an emergency room with an actual medical emergency, that being my father's broken ankle. And it was kind of surprising on a Saturday evening to be in and out of an emergency room within like 6 hours. Like, I'd imagine it would have taken longer because they would have been like, just hold your foot, we'll get to you later. Nope, it was pretty thorough and pretty through. I mean, I have a younger brother who's a med student, and we got a bit more information, but more or less that's pretty much the process. And it's, guys, I am surprised at medicine in my country. I mean, I hear every day from my younger brother, who I mentioned is a medical student, him going, guys, hospitals aren't equipped, we're totally screwed. And then seeing this and going, might be alright for now. Like, I mean, anything short of cancer, we might be able to handle it for our little tiny country. So that's kind of what took up my last month, World Cup and broken legs, which I guess kind of go well together because it's football and on occasion people break legs. But anyways, everyone's fine, no need to worry, we don't need your, well, I guess we need your comfort, your support. No, we don't, we're good. He's alright, I hope he'll not harass me too much and make me go batty. But he's going batty, and I'll have to deal with that. But anyways, this week's episode, I get to sit down and talk about the Terrence Malick film, The Thin Red Line, with my guest, Bran J. Rowan, from DareFilm.net, as well as the host of The Film Stage Show over at TheFilmStage.com, which is a site I used to write for many a moon ago. You can still find him on my columns up there. It's really nice to have that. I know the guys who run that site, Jordan and Dan, and they're great people. They're great, like, they are probably two of the best editors I've worked with over my last years of writing on the internet and being so wonderful to be able to write for other websites on occasion. But yeah, Brian is on the show and he's great. We talk about everything from war to debating films to recognizing that we are weird as cinephiles and enjoying it. So take a seat, enjoy the show, and please let me know if these intros annoy you, because I'm actually enjoying just doing these elongated intros about myself, because yeah, I'm gonna be a little selfish for now. But let me know, do these intros annoy you? I hope they don't. So yeah, that's all I think I have to say right now, so just enjoy the conversation and hear.
In this world, a man himself is nothing. And there ain't no world but this one.
I've seen another world. Sometimes I think it was just my imagination.
If I go first, I'll wait for you there. On the other side of the dark waters. Why should I be afraid to die? I belong to you.
I'm just going to start right here and say, hi, Brian. Thank you so much for coming here.
Thank you for having me. I was surprised and flattered when I got your Twitter message followed by your email asking me to be on.
Oh, I'm so happy that you're surprised, because like, people need to stop thinking that I planned this thing with a lot of thought. Brian, you were just the only one who said yes. You have to just
remember
that. Oh, that
works. I'm cool. I'm fine with that. I'm just always surprised when people care about my opinion enough to ask for it. I've been doing the movie review thing for like 3 years now, and every time someone's like, hey man, what'd you think of this movie, I'm like, why do you give a shit? Oh right, it's my job. Okay, let me tell you.
No, I like to be that person when people do that I just send them a link. I'm like, there, that's what I thought.
Yeah, that's what I feel. It's like when you ask me to be on the
they get angry when the link doesn't have a star rating at the bottom.
Oh yeah, no, I don't. I stopped sending it to people because they're like, I just want to know if you thought it was good. I was like, well, then you came to the wrong person. That's not really how I roll. I write movie reviews for some other websites, and I'll finish the review and I'll send it in. They're like, this is brilliant. It's another piece of wonderful writing. What is the star rating? Or like, what's your letter grade? I'm like, I don't fucking know. Give it a B. No one can be upset with a B, right?
No one can be upset with a... Actually, I know a lot of people who are upset with bees because they are crazy people.
Well, there are certain people who, like, have a really skewed sense of, like, what the rating is. You know, it's like, well, if you say the movie's good, it should be an A. It's like, no. If a movie's a goddamn masterpiece, I'll give it an A. If a movie is, like, pretty good and entertaining, I'll give it a B.
I actually got into that debate, I remember, over To the Wonder. Because that movie is not good, right?
I love that movie.
I've changed my mind on it. And I guess we'll get into this a lot, but, yeah. But when I first saw it, I saw it at TIFF, and it was literally the last movie I'd seen in a 36 movie run over 10 days.
Jesus.
It was a double bill of The Master and To the Wonder, which ended
that is year. A fucked up day.
And
I and can probably beat that though. My the day I saw
about it, I just went, I like To the Wonder because default, and there were pretty pictures.
Yeah. I saw To the Wonder and Upstream Color in the same day.
Oh wow, that
at the end of the day, I was like, there's no such thing as narrative, man. But your rules of storytelling. A, B, C, storytelling is a lie.
Further, Upstream Color is brilliant. Sorry,
I love Upstream Color, yeah. Awesome. I loved both of those films.
But anyways, you are here to talk about another Terrence Malick film. You're here to talk about the 1998 film he made, The Thin Red Line.
Yeah.
And I guess I'm going to start like always. I wonder if people are bored of me starting here all the while by asking you, to tell me a little bit about the first time you actually saw this movie. Was this a theatrical viewing for you?
No. I wanted it to be, but I couldn't get anyone to take me to a nearly 3-hour long World War II film when I was 11 years old. I really wanted to see this film. I was going through this stage where I was reading a lot of books. I hadn't really yet found film as like a really important part of my life. I was more of a book reader back then. Still a big book reader now, so it's not like one took over the other. But I was really into books about war. And so I went to the library, went up to a librarian and was like, I want to read a book about combat. I want it to be focused on characters. And I just gave her this list of criteria, and she was like, here's The Thin Red Line. Have fun. So she hands me The Thin Red Line novel. And I'm reading it, and I'm enjoying it. And then the Thin Red Line movie comes out. And I really wanted to see it. No one would take me to it. And then finally, one day, I think we had like one of those free weekend passes to HBO at my house. And my parents basically sat us down with a TV guide and were like, highlight the movies you want to see, and we will tape them, and we will have them.
And that sounds a lot like what used to happen in my house.
Yeah, welcome to the goddamn 90s. I'm sure there's a 14-year-old out there listening who's like, wow, I didn't understand half of the words that guy just said. So I'm like 11 or 12, and I see The Thin Red Line, and I was like, oh, I remember that, like the trailer for that, and I remember reading the book, and I'm still into warfare, and so, yeah, I want to see that. So I go into it expecting, like, a video game, basically. Like, I just want combat. I want to see manly men, like, you know, taking the hill and, you know, charging a bunker. And I sit down to watch it one night when everyone else in my house is asleep, and I put it in, and it starts with this lyrical interlude of two soldiers amongst the, like, native people on these islands in the Pacific. And I thought at first that I had begun the movie too late, that maybe my parents had screwed up the recording time. But then I just kind of gave into it. And as it started going on, I was like, they're really not fighting anyone. And then they get to the beach scene, and I'm like, okay, now we're going to get like the Saving Private Ryan style. Nope. Still not a single shot fired. And I was like frustrated because I was young and I was bloodthirsty. But then the more the movie went on and the more I began to realize the way that it was delving into the characters, the more enthralled I was. And at the end of the night, it's like maybe 1 o'clock in the morning, and I'm this kid sitting on a carpet in front of we had just gotten like a big screen TV, like one of the really big ones for like the square box TVs that we used to have. And I'm crying, and I've never cried at a movie before. And it ends, and I was just completely staggered, like completely blown away. And I just remember having to begin it again immediately, and I watched until I was bleary-eyed, and then I had to go to bed. And it was just, it was something like something had shaken within me. Like, movies would never be the same, because now I knew movies were capable of making me feel this. Whereas previously, it had all been Top Gun and Independence Day. You know, movies were a quick adrenaline rush, and this one had just, like, destroyed me at the core of my soul. And this is actually probably the movie that not only is responsible for me loving movies, but for me getting into movie criticism, because this is the first movie where I had to really defend my opinion of it.
You were 12 years old, right? That's what you
I was
said.
Like, yeah, I was like 12.
I can imagine a 12-year-old having to defend this opinion to other 12-year-olds.
Well, it wasn't even 12-year-olds. That's the greatest part. I went to a beach house up in Michigan. It was a beach house on Lake Michigan that my family was sharing with some family friends of ours. And I brought the VHS with me and I was watching it. And then dinner happened, so I had to pause it or stop it. And I go to have dinner and everyone's like, you know, what are you watching? And I was like, The Thin Red Line. And the adults and some of the older kids were like, oh, I tried watching that. It was really boring. You know, it was like a lot of internal monologues. And I was like, yeah, but that's what's beautiful about it, is this like this intensity and this idea of like war in the heart of nature and how does man fit into it and being able to feel what these people are feeling and the ambivalence at the heart of everything. And one of the girls, one of the older girls, said something along the lines of, I think she was 17 at this point, and she said, if I want to watch something that like does all that, I'll watch a documentary. And I was just like, incorrect. A documentary could never do this. I was like, let's just sit down and have this out. And everyone's like, okay, Brian, no one wants to hear your opinions on The Thin Red Line. Shut the fuck up and let's have dinner. And so it was the first time where like I had my beliefs shaken, because you see Red Dawn and you're like, that was awesome. And everyone's like, yeah, it was awesome. And then you see Top Gun and you say, that was freaking awesome. And everyone's like, yeah, that was freaking awesome. And then you see The Thin Red Line. You're like, that was a powerful, emotionally moving experience, the likes of which I've never experienced before. And everyone's like, that movie was boring as shit. And you're a madman. And so it's the first time where like I have to think to myself, am I wrong about this movie? Because these are the older people who I used to get gratification from being agreed with. But now they're wrong, and I can see how they're wrong, and I can explain to them how they're wrong. And it was probably the beginning of me becoming the lovable, pretentious asshole that I am today.
I was actually, oddly enough, this has nothing to do, well, little, but almost nothing to do with what you just said. I was having a debate this morning at work about that very word, pretentious. And while I'm a lazy asshole, I will do what all lazy assholes do and refuse to actually prove my debate and ask someone else to prove it for me. So Brian J. Rowan.
Okay.
I was prompted with the thesis that pretentious comes from the word pretend.
Right.
Right?
You're putting on airs. You're being overtly intellectual just to prove that you can be.
So it does have to do with pretending then. It's nothing about, it's not being sincere, but being almost at the point of flaunting your intelligence over someone else or your opinions over someone else.
Right.
It has nothing to do with sincerity.
Well, that's the thing. I use that word about myself to rob it of its power, because I am very sincere, but people are so, I found this in my life, people are so not used to people expressing their sincerity in the way that I express it. So their only recourse is to call me pretentious. So I just lean into it.
I'm with you, and I think I'll adopt that very much so.
Excellent.
but you were talking about the idea of movies being this adrenaline rush. You mentioned films like Red Dawn, and you even mentioned to some event Saving Private Ryan, which now that I look it up, came out the very same year as Thin Red Line. It came out in the summer, and Thin Red Line came out in the Christmas.
And the reason, you know, obviously Saving Private Ryan has a lot more going on than just that. But on a reptilian level of your brain, I mean, Saving Private Ryan has some harrowing, really fast-paced action scenes. And The Thin Red Line denies you that, like, constantly. Like, the big combat scene is them taking this hill, this ridge in Guadalcanal. And it is a slow, torturous, completely devoid of like any really quick dramatic stakes. And it's just, it gives you this concept of the lingering pall of death over every single move that you make in wartime. So like, if you were to take me as a 13-year-old or a 12-year-old and show me Saving Private Ryan, I would probably latch on to the beach scene and the scene where they're fighting the tanks and the sniper duel. And I would be able to completely skip over all the other shit that's in that movie. You know, even now I forget that it begins and ends with a flash forward to the guy going to the cemetery.
That's actually something I forgot for a very long time until I rewatched it like a decade later to show my younger brother. And I was like, there's an old person in this movie?
Yeah, because you just forget. Because on some level, the filmmaking is so great during those action scenes, and Spielberg is a genius at creating scenes like that, that it loses a little bit of whatever other message it's trying to make because it's too thrilling. And there was, I forget who it was, I think it might have been Truffaut. Someone's going to correct me on this, it's fine.
Let's be clear, whoever corrects you on this is very pretentious.
Quite so. And I will love them for it. But they said something like, you can't make a truly anti-war film because the act of war is so compelling. Like, no matter how much, like, bloodshed and stuff you put in, there's still a part of the human brain that's seeing the explosions and hearing the gunshots, and you get this adrenaline rush from it, and you kind of wish you could be there.
That's actually something I remember thinking a while back. I remember I wrote a very short post, and I guess I'll link to it since I mention it now, in a while back, when for some reason I found myself rewatching Braveheart. And while I know there's a lot of stuff in that movie which is horseshit, when I'm watching it, to a certain level, sometimes I kind of end up watching it on the same level I'll watch a generic shoot 'em up action movie, where I am just so excited by all of the action in that movie that I start to forget that this movie actually follows a war, follows a struggle of a people, and I started to question the idea of that kind of movie making. And I'm kind of happy that we ended up shifting gears into Saving Private Ryan and know that thought, because I think that's what Terrence Malick is doing here.
Oh, yeah.
He is actually subduing the action and all of that bloodlust into a film which actually finds a way to make war unappealing as a cinematic experience.
Yeah, and it's the type of thing where, you know, the people who I talked with first who found the film boring, it's because they wanted those Saving Private Ryan moments. And then afterwards they could totally go, oh yeah, you know, war is hell and it destroys families. But isn't it so cool when they have the sticky bomb and they throw it on the tank?
Yeah.
But in this film, you literally have people who are on a boat who are just excited to get off and go prove themselves. And like, one of the guys is going to find a pistol because he's like, you know, once we get up on the shore against those samurai sabers, you're going to wish you had a pistol to help protect yourself. And instead, there's nothing. Like, they get there and there's this huge anticlimax where this horrible bloodshed from Saving Private Ryan is undeniably compelling and it's denied to these soldiers. And when Dahl, who is played by Dash Mihawk, I mean, he finally kills someone. And it's a huge moment for him and for us, because I think he's the first guy who kills someone that we can see. And he is just excited and terrified. And it really does drive home, like, this isn't a video game. This isn't some obstacle course you're going through. You just took a life. And there's a part of you that can never be the same because of that. And this is a movie, one of the few movies, I think, that really drives that home. Because even though we learn nothing about the guy who he kills on that ridge, just his sense of astonishment and metamorphizing, like the change within him, he says something along lines of like, you know, I killed a man, you know, that's the worst you can do. It's worse than rape and no one can touch me because this is a violation that is allowed now. And this is the world we're living in. And it's intense. And I remember watching it as a kid and just being like, oh, fuck me. Like, this is really rough.
So I'm going to go ahead and assume that your parents were not very strict about the kind of films you watched at that age. Because this movie, whilst not Saving Private Ryan level of action, thrilling, bloodlust, is kind of a crazy war movie nonetheless.
Yeah, they looked out for some things. But around that time, you know, when I was entering my teens, I think that especially because I'd been reading, I had read a lot of books that they were like, you should not have been reading this. Like, I would finish a book and say, Mom, Dad, I think you'd really like this. And they'd be like, oh, OK, well, let me read it. And then they'd start reading it and they're like, oh, this is good. Oh, wow. There's a lot of sex and violence in this. Well, our son seems fine, so it should be OK. And I think on some level, my dad actually told me a couple of years ago when we were talking that he remembers going to see movie like Days of Heaven in the theaters. So I think on some level they might have said Terrence Malick, you know, God bless him, if Brian can get into that, then why not?
Oh, wow. While I do nothing to besmirch my parents and their parenting tactics, God damn it, I wish I had a mother and father who were like, you should watch Terrence Malick. I totally want you to. I had to
They're
find
the type
that
of people
fucker
who,
on my own.
Well, I think they understood a lot about children, because like, I had an unedited VHS version of Top Gun. And at some point, when I was like 16...
What do you need to edit out of Top Gun?
There's a sex scene.
Ah, that's barely anything.
But the thing is, I'm watching this movie as like a 3-year-old. So like, at some point I was looking at this, I'm like, you know, there's a pretty like graphic softcore sex scene in this. And they're like, you didn't know what the hell was going on. You just kept saying to fast forward to the jet planes. I was
right.
Like, okay, yeah.
Because
that's right. The kid is not
gonna,
the kid's not going to give a shit about Tom Cruise banging his flight instructor when there's a MiG in the air that needs to be destroyed. So. I think they had an interesting handle on it, and I'm glad for that, because I can't imagine a world in which I did not see the Thin Red Line when I did is a bleak, bleak world indeed.
But bringing up the idea of war in movies, as we've been talking about, the idea that Terrence Malick kind of wants to touch on actually making us feel bad about watching a war. And even to go so far as to try and deal with the thesis that your older compatriot brought up, to being like, why not just watch a documentary? It kind of almost feels like a possible equal in this sense, because if you wanted someone to explain to you how horrible war is, just let them explain it to you. A lot of films, while being very good, are very hard to convey feelings, especially when they try to make it visceral the way that Terrence Malick does. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering for you, like, especially for a filmmaker like Terrence Malick, who up until recently, and it really hasn't been proven much so far, really hasn't been that prolific, so hasn't really given you that much of an outlet to enjoy his version of emotional filmmaking. Do you find yourself looking for that kind of experience elsewhere and finding it hard to find?
A little bit. If you're a fan of Malick, it's hard to find anything that reaches the level of what Malick does. You know, as soon as I found out that he was making other films, I was really excited. And being there when they announced that not only would we be getting To the Wonder, but we might also be getting like two other films of his, like within a couple of years of each other.
I believe it's all lies.
I keep seeing production photos though, so I have to assume that they will come out at some point. But I mean, it's Terrence Malick. He could finish principal photography and then spend the next 8 years editing. Like, that's just how he is. So,
I actually found it very weird watching The Thin Red Line the other day, which is a movie that actually I didn't see up until like around 2 years ago, where I watch it having already seen all of Terrence Malick's other films, looking at it and going, there is no way under the God-given sun anyone's giving this man this much money ever again.
No. I remember seeing his first two films and then just being like, Who thought this was a good idea? Like, I'm glad they did, because it's an insanely large movie with an insanely large budget for a guy who made two films and then disappeared for 30 years. But I'm glad they did. I'm glad that some madman was like, hell yeah, Terrence Malick is back. And then not only that, but I mean, this movie has one of the most spectacular casts ever put together under the world. Like, it's incredible.
I wonder if that's a time effect, though, because while there are a lot of notable great performances in this movie, and some were really big actors at the time, I mean, Nick Nolte gives a stellar, stellar performance. Mm-hmm. A lot of the rest are cameos and what at the time would have been unknowns. But
well,
today we look back
thing,
at it
yeah.
and we're like, that guy, I know him. I know Tim Blake Nelson.
It was crazy because like, it's just one of those things where people, like, there's the cult of Malick and people were like, oh, he's making another film. You know, they call up their agent. They're like, get me on it. I'll work for scale. And so he shoots all this stuff, and then when the movie comes out, no one even knows if they're going to be in it. Like, the lore is that Adrian Brody was supposed to be the main character.
Yeah.
And he's reduced to, like, two scenes. Each of them is, like, a five-second shot of him looking very distraught and very confused.
Last night, I was rewatching the movie, and I made my older brother watch the movie for the first time. He's not the biggest of Terrence Malick fans. But he had heard good things about it, so he decided he wanted to watch it with me. And when we got up to the end of the movie and George Clooney appeared out of nowhere, he just said, "Fuck you, Terrence Malick, how do you do that?"
Yeah, oh, and it's great because George Clooney shows up for literally like maybe three sentences worth of dialogue, and the last sentence trails off as someone else has a like voiceover.
Like, I feel like
it's beautiful.
It's almost like they had to have lied to George Clooney and given him a big ass monologue, and Terrence Malick's like, "Yep, cut that down to three lines."
It's like, okay, we got the gist of what he's gonna say, but now let's have Nick Nolte come back in.
But for a movie with a cast as large and as sprawling as this, where you're almost uncertain as to who you're really following, what is it that you kind of latch onto with this movie when you're watching it for the first time versus the 50th?
The first time I had no idea what the hell was going on. So I remember I was just kind of in it with whoever was on the screen. Obviously Nick Nolte is a powerful, you're in there with him. Like, you see, he commands your attention. I remember being really into, Captain Storos, played by Elias Koteas. And, just because he had such a paternal instinct to him, and he has like the really big, you know, battle of power with Nick Nolte, you know, whether or not these people are going to charge this hill. Oddly enough, Jim Caviezel, who plays Private Witt, when I was, you know, growing up, you know, the first couple times I watched it, I was like, I'm not entirely sure why I'm watching this guy. I don't get what he's bringing to the table. Even Sean Penn, not so much. I think the person that I actually might have latched onto with the most was Private Bell, which is played by Ben Chaplin. He's the guy who's got the wife back home.
Yeah.
And he's constantly thinking of her as he's in this battle, which, again, is not something that a lot of movies really go in for. Obviously, there's always the girl back home. There's always the letter. You know, if I die, like, you know, make sure my wife gets this. But they have him in the middle of these intense moments, and he's still thinking of her, and he's still trying to get back to her. And we go full spoilers on this, right?
Yeah, go right ahead.
Okay, sweet. So then, at some point, he gets a Dear John letter from her, and she's left him. Like, she's left him for an Air Force officer who's stationed stateside. And that was actually the part of the movie that made me cry the first time. Because we've never seen these two characters together in real time. We see it in flashback. And of course, as a Malick flashback, these people are doing things that no human couple would ever do together. But, you know, when you live in your memory, you see things differently. And it was an evocation of memory that was just so clear to me. And the way that he was picturing him and his wife, it made it clear so much how he felt towards her and what she meant to him. And so for her to send him this letter, you know, asking him for a divorce and everything, after all that he's been through and all the ways that he has used her memory to keep him alive, it was just devastating. And so that's the part that's always stuck out the most for me, was just the way that it shows you how, like, this, there's life outside of this war, like this battle, this pointless, meaningless battle for a hunk of rock that has a single airstrip on it, and all these men are dying, and all these lives are being destroyed just because of distance and everything. And it was just, it was like, at that point, it was too much. I couldn't fucking do it.
This just came to me. It's a weird thing, but unlike any other war movie that I think has ever been made that actually focuses on battles, I find it interesting that this movie never contextualizes the importance of their goal.
Yeah, no, the only way it does is to actually downplay its importance. Like, there's a point where John Travolta, another big-name guy who's in this movie for, like, 3 minutes, he says something along the lines of, you know, no one wants this hunk of rock, but the Japs put an airplane, like, or an airstrip on it, and so we're going for it. And it's basically like, this is the insanity of war. Like, this is a very inconsequential place, but they've made it fleetingly consequential, and so we need to take it.
Mm.
You know, there's like no strategic importance to the island except for the fact there's an airfield. And it's like the Americans don't really need the airfield, but they know they don't want the Japanese to have the airfield, so we're going in.
Yeah. Is it weird that I just looked up the box office numbers for this movie to see that it took... Apparently, it was reported that the budget for this movie was $52 million, and it raked in almost $100 million. And I'm kind of guessing that makes sense, because it really wouldn't be too hard to sell a World War II film at this stage of the game.
Yeah. I'm surprised that it actually was only $52 million, but I mean, I guess back then, you know, that was a lot. I mean, what was... Do you know what Saving Private Ryan was?
Oh, I can look it up, but I'm sure that was amazing.
Saving Private Ryan. I just looked it up. Lifetime gross was 200 something. The budget was only 70 million. Yeah. I mean, that's insane. Because if you... I mean, I don't know what inflation is. I'm not good with economics. But I would assume that a movie like this nowadays would take at least 150 million.
Yeah. And
I mean, the scale of this thing is incredible.
But honestly, when you look at it, they're not that much effects work when it comes to digital effects. There were...
They just
a couple
had to
explosions
get
and
stuff.
Just and it was just about making the mountain, the rock look like it was blown to shit versus when the grass was on it.
Yeah. Well, it's true. And then of course again, all the stars in this, they were either, you know, in their twilight years and so they were willing to take anything, or even the up and comers were willing to take anything. I mean, one of the another piece of the lore of this film is that people were willing to work on scale, so they didn't get, you know, their usual couple million. They were willing to work at a reduced wage in order to work with Malick, which is great for us.
for us who have to who get to enjoy this film, which tells us war isn't good like every other war film.
But this is the only one that really succeeds. Like when I was a kid and I would play war with my friends, and you know, you'd be like, you know, charge the beach, get up the hill, like we would think of every film but this one. Because there was never a point when we were make-believe playing war where we wanted to have to stop and look at a dead enemy soldier and imagine their monologue.
That, I think, was one of the craziest things I noticed rewatching that movie this last night. That scene where that must have gone over my head, or I just didn't notice it at the time because it's such a small moment. But the voiceover changes to a dead person.
Yeah. The crazy thing is, and then, I mean, that's one of those things where, like, I've had moments like that, not, like, looking at an actual dead person, but just, like, looking at something and kind of giving it a voice. And I just looked up the quote. I mean, the Japanese soldier says this, and it's terrifying. It says, "Are you righteous? Kind? Does your confidence lie in this? Are you loved by all? Know that I was too. Do you imagine your suffering will be any less because you loved goodness and truth?" And it's like, well, yeah, I did imagine that. And now I know it's not real, because everyone, you know, in Saving Private Ryan, they humanize maybe like one German soldier and then he knifes a guy to death.
Right. In one of the most frightening death scenes ever put on film.
Yeah. But it's like exploitatively grotesque. Like I am repulsed by that scene just because they go out of their way to make it as awful as possible. And it's effective. I'm not going to say it's not effective. And, you know, Saving Private Ryan is a good movie. You know, don't get me wrong. As a filmmaking standpoint, it's great. But, like, this Japanese soldier saying that just completely decimates even the hope of heroism during combat. And it takes away the moral clarity that usually comes along with films like this. Because at the end, it doesn't matter what you're fighting for. What matters is who you were. And, like, you know, you all have the same concepts. You all have these same ingrained ideas where it's like, I'm a good person. Like, the world must have something for me. Like, there must be something that will protect me in the morality and in the hope and the joy and the love that I carry. But at some point, you realize, no, there's nothing like that. And when death comes, it comes cold and dispassionate, and it comes for everyone.
I'm kind of curious, given all of this context about war, and I know in the late 90s we had a lot of films giving us lots of context and lots of bloodlust or even anti-war messages talking about war, but I'm curious if you've ever seen and what it kind of played on these feelings that you've had, especially for this movie, the documentary from last year, The Act of Killing. The idea of war and the morality of it and the people involved in it.
Yeah, I did see The Act of Killing. I thought it was a pretty good film. I thought it was just okay until the final scene. And then it kind of struck me a little better. And that was the crazy thing about that is that like that movie is even more chilling because like these people aren't even quite calling it a war. Like in The Act of Killing, they're thinking of it as like a police action and like a cleansing. And it's just like that's even more chilling. And the way that they kind of swagger about, you know, with impunity and the way that they take this opportunity to shoot a movie about what they've done and that they try to take in all of these genre tropes that they were obviously emulating in their heads. Like that's bleak. Like that movie, it really like chills you to like the depths of humanity's ability to just destroy whatever light of goodness there might be in it. And that's one of the only reasons that the movie is in my head worth recommending is because at the end, you know, you've gone through this kind of deadening repetition of watching these people, you know, act out this glory day as they see it. And then you see the guy finally come to a sense of humanity and a sense of like enormity with what he's done.
Yeah. And I like thinking about that very same emotional arc that we get with The Act of Killing. It's kind of one of the things I focused most closely on rewatching The Thin Red Line last night, as I found myself focusing a lot on Nick Nolte. Mm-hmm. I remember from seeing him get his orders from John Travolta, where he's like, yeah, we don't really know what the hell we're doing, but we're doing it anyways. Going to demanding that Elias Koteas, who I'm sorry for the life of me, I will never stop calling him Casey Jones. I don't care what movie he's in. He's Casey Jones. I'm sorry. It's just a thing with me.
Understandably.
Yes, guys, I love the Turtles. And
you like cricket? You gotta understand crumpets to understand cricket. Okay. Yeah,
and you have to understand, as a Jamaican, I do love cricket.
So Casey Jones is your man.
Right. I'm breaking out of my mode of thought just for all of this Turtles nonsense. Moving forward towards having that debate with Elias Koteas over the radio saying that they have to take the hill, to when he actually gives that speech to Elias Koteas face to face about how he's going to send him back home. He's going to mark him down as ill or whatever he says. To also having that conversation with John Cusack, where he talks to him about the idea of being passed over. And yeah, more importantly, the idea of this being his first war, being an old man, as opposed to John Cusack and everyone else,
like,
who are all young men.
War. This is my first war. Yeah. Right. It's just really nuts because it gives you the idea of, you know, he's been trained for this, and this is where he defines his worth.
Yeah, it's kind of fucking crazy to think about someone who decides war is a career.
Yeah.
Right? And I mean, while we've all seen the movies like the Pattons, where that is kind of made into a good thing to some effect, where they're honing their skills as a warrior, has made them the perfect tool for actually enacting war. And we just happen to be contextualizing ourselves completely within a sense of war. We're happy for them to be the warriors they are, right? If this movie was a different movie, we probably would have had Nick Nolte as the hero. Right?
Yeah.
Because he's the guy who's going to shout at you and make sure you get up that hill and take the position. But at the same time, becomes one of the weirdest and most one of the saddest parts of this movie to watch a guy be sad that he wasn't able to be the true warrior he was in his lifetime.
Yeah. It's nuts.
This movie is balls out crazy though.
It is. The scope and what it's trying to do is insane. The movie begins with an alligator moving into an algae-covered pond as there's, like, this very ominous tone just playing in the background. I mean, what more movie would start like that?
All right.
Even there, it's just like, this is it. This is the darkness. This is what's lurking. Like, get ready, because it's only going to get worse. And then isn't the last... I think the last scene is a coconut sprouting on, like, a rock in the middle of the ocean.
Honestly, I've always stared at that image and kind of wanted to figure out exactly what it is. Because I look at it, and one day I look at it, and I see a helmet with a chute on it. The other day I look at it, I see a rock with a tree attached to it. I can never decide exactly what it is, and I've never looked it up.
That image, I mean, I've always read it as like a rock with a coconut on it that's sprouting a tree. And I mean, like, they make this point a few times. This is one of the few war movies that, like, really acknowledges the fact that conflict is not a solely human doing. Like, a lot of times you hear about war as, like, this great machine that chews up the young and spits out the dead. But in this film, there's an overriding metaphorical sense of, like, this is just nature. Like, we may think we're above it, but we are nature, and nature defines us, and nature says to kill and to take and to fight. And so while it's making all these pronouncements about the slaughter and the utter chaos that ensues both on a moral and physical sense, I mean, it says, you know, this is nothing to be flinched from. Like, this is where we come from. This is how we've created ourselves, and this is how we will continue to create ourselves. And it doesn't look at it fatalistically. Like, it's not a nihilistic film, because even at the heart of all this destruction are still people with hopes and dreams and the ability to love.
So one thing that I feel I'd be remiss if I didn't talk about, you mentioned very early about this movie being the film that started you actually debating movies on another level with people around you. Terrence Malick is a filmmaker who, let's just say, isn't going to be one of the popular culture in the near future. And being a huge fan of his work, how has debating his oeuvre, I'm going to give myself a pretentious point for using that word.
I was about to say, well done.
Debating his work over the years, done to you as a film enthusiast, a film critic, just a general lover of movies?
The one thing it's done is it's taught me not to fear sincerity. A lot of people in film, they will flinch from any film that is sincere. They view irony and they view snark. I hate the word snark. Fuck snark. They view irony and they view
oeuvre. You can say snark.
But snark is it's a word that's been corrupted for me, and I don't like using it anymore. People seem to think that snark is, it's done for its own sake, and you know, it's a way of belittling a criticism. So I don't like using snark. There's my rant against snark. oddly enough, now I've used the word snark more than I've ever used it before. So kind of did the opposite of what I wanted to do.
I'd like to give you a point for that whole spiel.
Excellent. What's the point system on the show? How do I win?
Have I won
the show?
There's never any winning.
Damn it. Okay. But anyway, like, there's a sense of you need irony. You can't just put it out there. Like, you can make your point, but the point has to be cloaked in something else. You can't put your heart on your sleeve. And that's a problem, because a lot of the movies that I really love don't flinch away from doing that. I mean, a movie like The Fountain, which is another movie that I absolutely love.
One of my all-time favorites.
It is a beautiful, powerful, moving film, but the film doesn't undercut its own message by ever having someone winking at it. Like, a man in that movie literally says, "We're going to cure death." And he says it with conviction. He means it. It is in his heart, it is his goal. And no one there says, you know, "Oh, well, you know, why don't we just cure baldness while we're at it? Ha ha." No, the movie takes it seriously. And people will rally against that. People will become incensed if a movie dares to take itself seriously and its message seriously. So in constantly loving and defending Terrence Malick, I've had to kind of cultivate this thick skin, oddly enough, about people who hate movies that take themselves seriously, movies that will allow themselves the courage of their convictions to say, this is a movie about love. This is a movie about failure. This is a movie about the religious experience of falling in love and trying to fight God himself to get it. Because a lot of times that impulse towards sincerity can lead to things like treacly saccharine nonsense. I mean, like, we're not talking about rom-com love and sincerity here, because in my heart, I feel that most of that is pretty cynical. Like, that's trying to make you weep, or that's trying to make you fall in love with the character. But the sincerity in movies like this or The Fountain, it's a sincerity that you can't bottle. It's a sincerity that's felt so deeply that it's almost like this director doesn't know how to not do it this way. And so dealing with critics who are either younger and are afraid of actually like showing any heart, or critics who are older and who have become jaded and want the kind of pulp sensibilities that someone like a Quentin Tarantino would bring to a story like this, you know, this concept of sincerity and earnestness is just staggering to them. Like, they don't like old books where women will talk about being in love and start crying. You know, Anna Karenina would probably be a nightmare for some people to read, because there is not an ounce of irony in that book with its regard to society and love and the importance of love in life. And so having to be a Malick fan, because I definitely didn't choose to do this to myself.
You are born like this.
Yeah, basically. It's taught me that, you know, sincerity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to laugh.
No, I mean, it's true. Like, my life would be a lot easier if I had no sense of sincerity, if I was able to just live purely off of a sense of irony. But, you know, there is a sincerity to me. And as much of a defeatist, you know, depressive nihilist as I am, I love movies that deal with things with sincerity. I love that moment where, you know, someone says something that's true and that sounds just bottled up and stupid, and but it rings so true that you can't deny its power. Like, just almost literally every line of dialogue in To the Wonder is dripping with sincerity, a sincerity that could cause a person to choke on it because it's just too true. And it doesn't even bother. Like, anything said by the priest in that film. I mean, love is to run the risk of failure and betrayal. I mean, like, it's things that we know but we never say, because to say it makes it too real. And reality and opening yourself up to hurt frightens the shit out of us.
It does. And sincerity is something that over the years I've become more and more accepting of in movies. I mean, I'm the guy on my podcast who every week is going to bat for the Spielberg movie, going to bat for the Malick film, going to bat for the Carruth film.
Yeah.
Always
Spielberg loves sincerity.
Oh, hells yeah. One of my favorite movies of his in the last few years is War Horse.
War Horse! Right? Yeah.
And like, love War Horse. At the end of the day, like, it is, as you say, one of those movies which telegraphs what it's about, which says, I want to be this, and it is this wholeheartedly. And it's unabashedly lovingly for it. Yeah. I loved Lincoln.
He can dip into that danger zone, though, where it does become a little too saccharine for me. I mean, War Horse. Oh, my God. Like, I love War Horse. Don't get me wrong. I'm a huge fan of War Horse. But there are moments in that movie where it's like, if this man were less talented, I would be laughing right now.
Like, yeah, and that's the one thing
on his
I wanted
craft
to
more than his thought a lot of times. But he wins. It works.
It totally does. But talking about that moment, that almost Rubicon that movies can reach.
You were just like, ever since I said the word pretentious, you've just been like trying to outdo me. Rubicon? Seriously?
I am trying extra hard today, sir. Okay. I'm trying extra hard. And to impressed. Let you know on a side note, no, you have earned the most points this podcast has ever given out.
Woo.
So is that winning in itself?
Maybe. I think I've won.
You think you've won. Yeah. where they are just being sincere, and as you say, saying things which are obvious, but at the same time, we don't say enough. Saying I love you, crying at the fact that someone didn't. All of these things, what I feel people are actually refusing about these things in movies, which they always start to laugh it off, isn't so much their own insecurities or their own fears, but the fact that they are things we know as facts, right?
Right.
We do need people to say I love you. We do cry when people don't say I love you, and all of these other things. And the fact that a movie feels it needs to remind us of this fact can come off as somewhat just aggravating. Like, to make this argument a little bit more redundant, earlier this year, Captain America came out. And while I enjoyed that movie, my brother was discussing it with me, and he said one of the reasons that he isn't a big fan of that movie is because for about the first hour, it's setting up a story which we already know is about to happen within the first 5 minutes. And he wanted the movie to figure out how to get past that setup in like 15 minutes so that we could get to all the great parts of the movie. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of the discussion you would have for why someone didn't like War Horse or Lincoln or even the tree. The Thin Red Line, where in about 15 minutes, you figured out that this movie is about war sucks.
Right? Yeah. I mean, like, in War Horse, you could basically just have the guy, you could cut out every part where they get the horse. You could just have the guy, like, selling the horse, and the kid running over and be like, it's my horse, I love this horse. And you're like, I guess that kid loves his horse. But Spielberg has the balls to spend 30 minutes forging a relationship between this kid and this miraculous fucking horse.
This amazing fucking horse.
It works, too. I mean, like, it was that movie and We Bought a Zoo. Came out in, like, the same year around the same time.
Oh, my goodness. I actually liked that movie a lot.
I loved We Bought a Zoo.
I put that into my top 10 of the year that year.
We Bought a Zoo was a great movie.
Great movie.
I think for each of them, I wrote something along the lines of, like, these movies don't pluck at the heartstrings. They play them like a goddamn power chord. They're just like, here are your heartstrings. And then they do like the windmill thing as they just hit it over and over again. But again, those are two filmmakers who know that well enough that you don't feel like a sucker for crying at it. You know, you don't feel manipulated. You're just like, this is someone who believes in these things and doesn't have a problem putting true emotion on the screen. And so those two movies, like, yeah, I mean, one night at my house, I live with some other people, and my roommate and his girlfriend came over, and they're like, hey, we're gonna like have a drink and watch a movie. And I was like, oh, okay. And they're like, we'll pick a movie, we'll go make the drinks. And so I pick We Bought a Zoo. And they thought I was joking at first. I'm like, no, it's a really good movie, you should watch it. This guy and his girlfriend cried three different times at three different points in the movie. So independently, they each picked three different times to cry. And they hated me. They never let me pick a movie again. Because they're like, oh, We Bought a Zoo. Ha, ha, ha. And then all of a sudden, like, one of the guys is crying. The girl had gone up to get another drink. She's like, oh, my God, what did I miss? And he's like, he used his son's picture of the tiger on the side of the zoo. And she hears this, and she starts crying. She's like, oh, my God.
Well, Brian, I'd like to give you an applause, because you're a lot better person than me, because I would have been the guy who said, let's watch Blue Valentine.
Another movie that gets an emotional reaction, but a different kind.
Then she would just look at him and be like, this isn't going to work out,
is
it?
This is over.
Anyways, Brian, I'd like to thank you so much for coming and talking with me today about this movie, because regardless of what anyone thinks about this movie, I think you should be able to kind of push him towards the outcome of being like, maybe I should like this movie more. Maybe I should give it more of a shot. Because I'm sure there are many out there who look at this movie and was like, that was 3 hours of nonsense.
Yeah, I've met a lot of those people.
I know you've met a lot of
those. I met a lot of those same people, again, for The Tree of Life and then To the Wonder. So.
I will say, however, since we're mentioning Malick, without a doubt, after all of these years of deciding and jumping and hemming and hawing, my favorite Terrence Malick film remains The New World.
Oh, I love The New World. I love all of his films. I mean, each of them has a different thing. I say that this is my favorite because it's the first one I ever saw, and it's so important to me. But I mean, The New World...
The New World was actually the first one I watched, now that I think about it.
I had to wait like 5 or 6 years for the New World. That was a pain in the ass.
I'm pretty sure it was, because you would have seen the Thin Red Line and you'd have been like, where's more?
Yeah, I saw it. I was like, oh, this is great. I can't wait for this guy's next film to come out in 2 years. Because that's just what I thought directors did.
You thought they were actual jobs that they did.
Yeah. I didn't realize that they could like step away and be like, oh, I got $3 million. I can live off that for a while. They can go and become like a philosophy professor in France for 30 years.
Oh.
I can't imagine. I cannot even imagine if I'd been alive when his first two films came out. And then he just stopped.
What I always tell everyone who gets into that kind of impatient mode of being like, where's his next movie 3 years later? I'm like, look, at the end of the day, there are all of these movies we can watch. And regardless of how much you want to say all of them are horrible, there's still 20 every year that you're going to love.
Yeah, right? And I've gotten around to that. But I mean, a Malick movie is special to me.
Yeah. And isn't it more special that it only happens once a decade? Well, not anymore. Not anymore.
It's easy to say that. It's easy to say that now, but, you know, it's still aggravating.
You're still calling the Terrence Malick hotline saying, where is it?
Yeah, is it back? Is he there? Can you get him on the phone? Because what was it? I mean, I saw the Thin Red Line maybe, like, let's say 99, 2000. Then I had to wait 5 years for the New World. And then people were like, oh, he's working on this other thing. It's going to be really great. And then it was like another 7 fucking years.
That was the Tree of Life, right? There wasn't anything until the Tree of Life.
Nope. I was just like, oh, the New World was so good. And then he came out with those movies within 6 years of each other. So I was fine for like maybe 5 or 6 years. But then it took the Tree of Life until like 2012 to get released here, stateside.
Wow.
I think. I'm pretty sure that's when it came out.
Yeah, it was about 2012. No, it was 2011.
Well, it was 2011 at Cannes, right? Did it come out that same year in America?
I think it was, or at least it should have, because I think I saw it in 2011.
I don't know. I saw it its opening day. I remember that much.
I remember it's relatively early in my employment in Trinidad, and I started Trinidad in September 2011.
Okay.
So it should be somewhere around there. Anyways, once again, I'm going to thank you again. Because that's how I like to thank people and end the podcast. So thank you so much, Mr. Brian J. Rowan.
Thank you again for having me.
And finally, after 3 tries, we finally get to talk.
Yeah.
Right, so that was it. Once again, thank you so much to Brian for coming on the show and talking with me. I damn well enjoyed the conversation. Listening back to it, I was like, yeah, a lot of these things, like when we started talking about sincerity, I'm happy we talked about that, because that's something that kind of bugs me, and bugs me about movies, bugs me about people talking about movies, bugs me about people in general, and I kind of want to applaud more and more every time I see it in movies. But on a side note, that's a show, that's not really a side note, I'm just kind of flummoxed and not really sure how to end this. So, as always, you can go and subscribe, rate, review the show over on iTunes. Just look for the Movies You Love podcast or search for my name, Andrew Robinson, and it should pop up. And guys, I'd really love it. Like, I don't think I'll ever, ever become that guy who seeks donations to keep my interneting going. I don't know. Maybe it'll happen. But not, for now, I have no interest in doing that. I just want to keep publishing. I just want to keep making and keep enjoying myself like I'm doing right now. But guys, what I'd really appreciate from you all is just go and rate and review the show over on iTunes, because it would do the show a great help. And I want the show to do well, as I hope you guys listening do too. So yeah, go do that. Go follow Brian on Twitter. He is at Brian J. Rowan. You can go and listen to his stuff over at The Film Stage Show over at thefilmstage.com, and you can go and read all of his articles over at darefilm.net, where he does a nice little thing of writing reviews in the form of letters to movies. So you could even go and read what he wrote about The Thin Red Line and hear him write to The Thin Red Line about how much he loves it. It's kind of cool. So once again, thank you so much for listening, and enjoy your evening, your day, your morning, whenever you're listening to this. Guys,